Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. I am bringing out all kinds of horsepower, heavy-duty firepower, maybe that's a better way of saying it, to help you understand some of the things that we deal with in the financial world. And so we're going to get naked on today's program. How's that sound? Well, that's provocative. Naked Economics is the name of the book. And there's also Naked Statistics, both books now having been written by Dr. Charles Whelan. And the doctor's on the line with us. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Now, let me give it a proper introduction. Dr. Whelan holds a PhD in public policy from the University of Chicago, a master's in public affairs from Princeton, and a Bachelor of Arts from Dartmouth College. Boy, you are just one overeducated fellow.
I know. I'm trying to overcome that, and I think I've done okay.
No, that's actually very impressive, and you've earned it, and you're a doctor on my program, so thanks for being with me. You've written a couple of books, and I went to the website myself, Naked Economics. You are a provocative guy as well. That's a very interesting title for a website, but also for a book. And then you followed it up. It wasn't enough to be naked with economics. You decided to get naked with statistics as well.
Correct. And when you said we were going to get naked, it's less provocative on a radio show than I think television.
Well, okay. So, you know, my listeners are going, what in the world kind of program is David put together today? I mean, what's he doing? What's he drinking over there? So here's the thing. What is this all about? Are you trying to strip it down to the naked essence? What this has to do with money and finance, right? And economics?
Yeah, I think at some point we had a working title along the lines of the bare essentials or something like that. Because the idea was that economics is too important to be messed up with math. It's not to say that math doesn't matter and the formal models are unimportant and so on, but it is to say that too many people suffer through Econ 101 and they don't get the big picture.
And
I'm a policy guy.
Yeah, they tune out. Yeah.
Right? They never take another class. I mean, one of the failings of our system is we teach Econ 1 as if everybody in the class is going to go on and get a PhD. So there's all this mental scaffolding.
Yeah.
That obscures the big idea. So, I mean, the evolution of the book is actually kind of interesting. Naked Economics was written essentially by accident. I was writing for The Economist magazine. I was teaching at Medill, which is the journalism school for Northwestern. And I was teaching an economics and finance class for journalists. I assumed that there was a book out there that was not a textbook that would elucidate the big ideas about economics without bogging them down the math. I literally called somebody in the publishing industry and said, I haven't found it, but I know it's there. Where is it?
Right.
There was this long pause, and she said, huh, there isn't one, but you're going to write it, and we're going to call it Economics for Poets.
Nice.
The title changed, but that is where the idea was born.
That makes sense, though, because a lot of the poets were naked. So that
yes, exactly right. They were living in a different world.
They were living in a different time in a different world. Well, you know, I will confess to my listeners, and they've never heard this, but one of the classes that I actually hated the most in college was just economics. I mean, it was just boring. And thank you. Thank you, doctor, for breathing some life into a subject that I think for a lot of people, even a financial guy like me, I couldn't get out of that class fast enough and into stuff that was even more interesting, the accounting. Imagine that.
Right. Here's the mystery, which is how much effort it must take to make it uninteresting, right? Because there's really, no matter what you care about, if you care about running a business and prices and all those kinds of things, if you care about federal spending, if you care about poverty, if you care about Africa, if you care about economics, is fundamentally the most important tool. It doesn't explain everything, but it's a really core tool for understanding all of those things. And most of us have some interest in one of those things I described. So to me, it's mind-boggling that we can kind of beat the inherently interesting stuff out of the subject.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. And I think that it is, like you said, where they're trying to prepare people for everyone who goes on to get their PhD in economics. Or it's also, so there's kind of overlooking some of the basic needs that everyday people have. And it's also an effort maybe from, I don't know, those that want to maintain control or power or an advantage over others. I don't know what it is, maybe keeping the mass in Latin, so to speak. But it seems like a lot of things. And I ran into this when I was prompted in a similar way, although I didn't get asked to write a book. I volunteered to do it. And I wrote my book because I saw a big hole that I couldn't find a book that was a basic thing that was real world about how people plan their retirement. So there's this whole big area where it just seems to be a gap. And because we need this, as you say, in so many different ways to solve the local or the world problems.
Yeah. I mean, I think, holding tightly the keys to the temple is a very apt analogy. And in three areas that we've talked about already, there is a huge social cost to people not knowing the basics. That would be true with retirement and investment. The people you know, there's some core things you have to understand about risk and reward and compound interest and everything else. The same is true with economics, which is if you're going to be an informed citizen, you have to understand how things work, what incentives cause people to do what things. And the last one is statistics. As we enter this era of big data and people are just going to be bombarded by numbers, that they really have to be discerning consumers of that information.
Well, I don't think there's any question. If our country, and this is not, you know, soapbox or wishful thinking, but if we just knew a lot more about the way money works and our financial system works, you know, I just think that it would be much better, more informed and, you know, well-thinking, for lack of a better way to put it, voters and population, we would do a lot better with some of the decisions that are made for us or that we allow people to make in trying to run our country.
Yeah, and I think one of the points I make with my students is economics will never give us the right answer. It's not going to tell us what the right size government is or what kind of safety net you want. But if we all have a core understanding of economics, we will have a better discussion of those topics. And it will most likely cut off the most extreme plans of left and right because we'll figure out that they just don't make any sense. There's still going to be honest intellectual disagreement. That's been true since the founding of the nation. But it's going to be underscored with data. It's going to be more respectful. We'll be able to separate fact from opinion. And we will have better discourse around these important issues.
Excellent. Well, I think everybody would applaud that. We're going to take a quick break, Dr. Whelan. Dr. Whelan is on our program talking about Naked Economics. NakedEconomics.com is the website, and we'll be right back after the short break.
Have you noticed most of the financial literature available is either so specific it doesn't apply or too generic to answer even the most basic questions? This revelation inspired David Holland to write his first two books, Confessions of a Financial Planner, Secrets to a Secure Retirement, and How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Financial Scams. These how-to guides contain easily accessible information on a wide variety of topics concerning personal finances. An effortless weekend read. You'll find clarification on what a mutual fund is, how to choose the right financial professional, and much more. Call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN to request a free excerpt from David's first book, Secrets to a Secure Retirement. The number again is 888-747-7526. Or visit davidholland.com for more information on this innovative book series.
We are back. Some more Naked Economics from Dr. Charles Whelan. And, you know, we're talking about his book. There's a couple of books out, Naked Economics and Naked Statistics. And I've got to ask, you know, we talk about the critical need, Dr. Whelan. Give me a flavor, and I'm going to look for my copy. If I don't see one come in the mail, I'm going to order my own. And I want a peek inside the book. Is it helping people understand in plain English economics and how it affects what we do? Is that the thrust of the book? And
pretty much. I mean, I think the idea is to underscore what these tools are. Some of them are quite basic. You know, if you change prices, then you change behavior. That's one of the most powerful levers we have. And economists think much more broadly about prices than everybody else. So waiting in traffic congestion is part of the cost of your commute. So if you get rid of traffic congestion, the cost of your commute goes down. So a lot of it is bigger than dollars and cents.
I got you.
But it's understanding how powerful those things are in terms of changing behavior. And also, I think, you know, the two of my favorite chapters, the chapter 3 that I think is called something like A Round of Applause for Government, which is, all right, you know, we actually need government to set the rules, basic rule of law, justice system, a sound currency, weights and measures. There are things that government has to do to make the economy work. It's the tracks on which the economy runs. Chapter 4 is don't get too excited about chapter 3 because there are a lot of things that government shouldn't do. You know, because if government were all good, then North Korea would be an economic powerhouse. And it's kind of, all right, well, here are things that government tends to get wrong or shouldn't be doing. Those two chapters, I mean, again, I talked earlier about kind of cutting off the tails. I think those two chapters frame the important things to understand about the strengths and limitations of the market and the strengths and limitations of intervening in the market.
That's very interesting. I love your analogy of, you know, how economists look at the price or the cost of being in traffic. And it's a much bigger picture like that than just simply dollars and cents, because, you know, there's statistics that, and again, hence your next discussion about naked statistics. But there's statistics that are cited about how many billions of dollars or whatever the order of magnitude is that is wasted people sitting in traffic. And we look at that cost and we compare that to the cost of road work to add another lane. And it's not even a comparison, right? But sometimes it's hard for us to get our mind around the cost of road work when we don't have that larger framework.
Yeah, and I think that your economists would go one step further and they'd say, okay, if you build the additional lane, then let's think about what the, you know, and if traffic gets better for a while, then people might move to new places and say, well, the commute's not that actually that bad, so it might become self-defeating. So a lot of it is this kind of recursive thinking that, you know, there's going to be, you'll change something and then there will be a response to that change and you want to see how things settle out in equilibrium.
That's very interesting. You know, I want to jump kind of to the end and we'll come back to the middle of our conversation today, Dr. Whelan. Why, and I know part of it is that stuff is not made readily accessible, and I've seen that a lot and we've talked about that earlier. But why is it that otherwise bright, intelligent people, and I've had plenty come through my door, they struggle to understand some of the most basic stuff as it relates to economics. They just don't get it. Why do you think that is on a more of a global basis?
I think part of it is that, and this is true with statistics as well, that economics tends to be taught by people who love economics. Now, that stands to reason. On the other hand, what it means is that they think about it differently. They think in algebra. They think in calculus. They think in graphs and charts. Most of us don't, which is why, you know, most of us don't teach economics. The most insightful review of a book I've ever gotten was actually the review in The Economist magazine of Naked Statistics. And the first line was, most people who write statistics books love statistics. Charles Whelan does not love statistics. He loves what you can do with them. I'm a policy guy. I think it actually matters that, before I wrote this book, I wasn't an economics professor. I spent a year traveling around the world, and I spent 5 or 6 years writing about the world for The Economist magazine. And what I saw were real problems, many of which had economic concepts at their core. So I came at it not because I love the formulas or the elegance of the theories, it's because I care about the underlying issues and economics gets me traction on them.
So it's the means to an end, not necessarily starting with the end and working.
Unequivocally, I have no interest in esoteric theory that has no application. A lot of people do, and that's fine, but to me, you might as well be doing literary criticism.
Right. Yeah, and we just lost half our audience. Very good.
Yeah, exactly right.
Well, we're not going to lose them, and they're going to stick around. We're going to take a quick break. Dr. Charles Whelan is our guest today. NakedEconomics.com is a website, and stay right there. We'll be right back.
Many people invest without ever knowing what they pay in investment fees. When was the last time you dropped your car off for service and told them to fix whatever they want without getting an estimate first? I'll bet never. Why treat your portfolio any different? Holland Financial is ready to help. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your free consultation or visit us at davidholland.com.
Welcome back. Dr. Charles Whelan is our guest today, and he has a PhD in public policy from the University of Chicago and a lot of other really solid demonstrations of his intellect and capabilities in this field of economics. And we're talking about his book, Naked Economics and Naked Statistics, both of them on NakedEconomics.com website. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, Doctor, I'll just give you kind of some anecdotal examples or information, and you can tell me what you think of it, is I've had people come in and I'm talking with them, and I'm not picking on anybody out there, but I've had people come in, I've sent them a packet before they meet with me, I've sent them a copy of one of my books, I said, please read this before you come in if you can, or look at this, look at that, and it's not unusual that they just haven't had a chance to look at it, and we're talking about their retirement. We may be talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars that they need to figure out what to do with. And they may have spent the morning going to the furniture store instead of preparing mentally for my meeting. So is it just that we want things kind of pre-digested and given to us and like, okay, you're the financial guy, you just tell me? How do we get people to get in more involved or more invested, that's the word, in understanding how all this stuff works?
It's a great question, and I think one of the things that we've discovered, there's a whole new field called behavioral economics, and it started with questions like the one you just asked, which is, okay, our basic assumption in economics is that people are rational, and they do what's best for them. These are not Herculean assumptions.
Right.
And yet we're finding that people are not doing things that are good for them. So retirement planning is a perfect example. When you ask people how they expect to live in retirement, and then you look at their behavior, oftentimes you think you're talking about different people. Health is another one where people absolutely know mm-hmm. that they should be in better shape if they want to be healthy in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And you often see people who are doing things that are terrible for their health in the short run. So economists and psychologists and other folks began asking, what is it about the human condition that leads us to kind of underestimate this? And it turns out that kind of one of our flaws in decision-making as in humans is we tend to overly discount the future. That when things are far away, you know, that furniture you mentioned, that's now. We're doing the basement today, and we're going to get a new couch and retirement. Well, that's a long way away. And heart disease, that's a long, you know, and that we're just not very good at making decisions that affect the long term.
The current experience just completely takes over all of the other planning that we might do.
Right. And, you know, there are even evolutionary biologists getting into the game saying, well, you know what, that's actually not a bad way to live if you're a caveman. You know, you need to get through today.
Yeah.
And you know, there's not that much reward for thinking about 30 years from now if you might get bit by a snake or something. But we're not there anymore. And so the question is, what kind of tools, prompts, incentives can you give people to help them think more about the future? Can you simplify choices? Can you require certain education? Can you fine people for doing things that don't make any sense? Can you, you know, when it comes to things like getting in shape, there's quirky studies that show, for example, if you every time you go to the gym, you put your name in a bucket and they draw out and somebody wins a TV every once in a while, that's more likely to get you to go to the gym than the fact that it might prevent a heart attack. It doesn't make any sense, but those are the kinds of things that we respond to.
Very interesting. Yeah, I love the reference to the caveman, because if you're staring a saber-toothed tiger down out in a field, that's obviously much more pressing than how you're going to get bananas when you're 30 years older.
Right, exactly. There wasn't, for 50 million years, there wasn't a whole lot of payoff for being the long-term thinker.
Interesting. So it's that current gratification, because we know the actual chemical releases that occur in the brain from the immediate gratification of things. So I guess the trick, and it's not a trick, the hook is giving away the TV at the gym, or if we can get people to get that gratification by understanding and being invested in the moment, that I'm going to have to think through how to do that and get people to look at it. I want to get them to use the financial planner's brain and kind of move that caveman brain to the side long enough to get a plan put in place.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we're seeing is that oftentimes simplifying decision helps a lot. So if I give you 41 choices about retirement plans, chances are you're just going to stick them in a drawer and say, oh, God, you know, that's just more. If I give you 3, or if I'm your employer and I give you a default that makes a whole lot of sense and you just have to change it if you don't want that.
There you go.
You tend to get action, more wiser choices given people's risk profile and station of life and so on, which is contrary to what you think. I mean, standard economics says more choices is better.
Of course, right? But if you give them too many, they freeze. They can't. It's analysis paralysis, right? Or just tune out. You know, I read a study one time that talked about you get when you get up above five steps or choices or five things you have to think about to make something happen, it's just too much.
Right.
So
I think that's one takeaway.
Yeah. Well, how about this? How about instead of 3 choices, I just say, look, I'm a financial planner, know what I'm doing, here are my credentials, here is one step. This is what you should do based on everything you've told me. Now it's just yes.
Yeah. Or no. It doesn't even have to be yes. It can be or no, and then you've got to come up with another option. But if you don't come up with an option, we're going to stick with this.
Okay, very good.
And that, I mean, the evidence is very powerful on that. So, for example, if you're an employer and you have a 401k plan, the old model was, you know, here are 11 choices. If we don't hear from you, we're not going to deduct any money. We're not going to match.
And it never happens.
You know, that's free money. It's, to the extent that there is any free money, that's as close as you get, your employer match. So now the thinking is, all right, if we don't hear from you, we're signing you up for this plan, which is probably some index fund that's appropriate for your age, and we're going to match it. And you're free to change it to anything you want. But what we find is most people stick with where you put them.
Mm-hmm.
Which again doesn't make much sense, you know.
But it's
in
easy.
Theory, you're,
everybody
yeah,
wants to. Well, everybody wants to push the easy button, right?
Right.
Or
and
not
so
have to push a button at all.
Right. If you can make easy as attractive and sensible as possible, then you can get better outcomes.
I like it. Dr. Charles Whelan is our guest today, PhD in public policy, University of Chicago. He's written the book, Naked Economics and Naked Statistics, on the nakedeconomics.com website. Quick break. We'll be right back.
There are hundreds of annuities available in today's marketplace. How can you know if one is right for you? Certified financial planner David Holland answers this question and more in his educational booklet on annuities. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN. The annuity booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities so you can decide if one is a good fit for your situation. Again, that number is 888-747-7526.
Welcome back. Dr. Charles Whelan is our guest today, and I actually jumped on the couch there a few minutes before the break and got him to validate what I try to do helping people with their financial planning needs. And you know, I've done a lot of research trying to figure out how best to help people, and 5 steps is good, 3 steps is better, 1 step, you know, as close to zero as you can get. And we're talking about how to make this all this economic stuff easier. And I find all the times, doctor, that people are just so overwhelmed that they don't know where to start. So what do? They go the path of, well, let me ask a friend what they've done.
Right.
And then that power. And so what that person's done, which may have nothing to do or be completely inappropriate for them, they will place more weight on that than perhaps what I might put on the table for them after listening very carefully to what I think about their situation and all my experience and education and so on and so forth. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
Well, we've been talking about human decision-making foibles, and that's another one, which is good. There's actually a formal term, which is kind of anchoring effect, which is if you've had some experience with something, you know, if it rained yesterday, you just assume it's going to rain next week, even if there may be a weather forecast to the contrary. So if somebody else has said, boy, you know, I had angioplasty and it worked great for me, that's what they're going to do.
Now, it's going to heavily affect our decision-making.
Right. Even in the face of large-scale clinical trials suggesting it may not work for you, that the anecdotal is extremely powerful in our decision making.
And I think the reason for that is it is a very quick way of assimilating or getting to a point or overcoming the obstacle and the what seems to be such a mountain of information or difficulty, like, okay, well, that's just too much. Let me see if anybody else has had a good experience with this. And I'll just, okay, good, I'm going to do it.
Right.
Because I've got all these other things that I'm trying to decide on, or I just don't want to have to think any harder than that.
Right. And now, you know, that we can use that powerfully in a lot of disciplines if we find anecdotes that are consistent with the underlying data.
True.
Right. So, you know, if I'm trying to persuade you that putting money in a 529 account for your child is a wise thing to do, then I can tell the story about somebody who did this and it worked out well and their students now graduating from X college or something like that. So we should take advantage of the fact that people respond to stories. Politicians, of course, are very good at it, that the data will just put an audience to sleep. Whereas if we can find a particular person, then we kind of respond. But obviously, we want the anecdotal data to be consistent with what the facts and studies are telling us.
So as our listeners are listening, you and I kind of enjoy the psychoanalysis of people and how they make these economic decisions or their thought process. Let's turn it back for them. As they are going through life trying to make good decisions, what are some of the coaching that we can give them? Is it to become an economic or financial expert? No. What can we give them? We can give them your book. We can give them my book. But what can we impart to them in the last couple of minutes of our program today to help them be enabled?
I think it's what I tell my kids all the time, which is I can't teach you everything. All I can do is try and teach you to be a good decision maker.
Here we go.
And I think whether it's in the realm of finance, whether it's in the realm of making political decisions, whether it's making medical decisions, there is generally a process, and it should be information-driven. And you may not always be, you know, the literature may not be entirely accessible, but you know there are underlying facts on the ground. And I think that there's a process to these decisions that involves gathering data, consulting experts, listening to what they have to say, evaluating your own set of beliefs against what you've been told, and then making an informed decision. And I think that process matters. And I think the process applies to a broad range of life decisions.
Well, what you just described, as I was listening, that's getting a new car, that's picking where you're going to live, that's what mortgage you get, that's what bank you bank with, what financial planner you hire, what financial products you buy, what investments you do, where you decide to go to college, all those things. I think you've hit the nail on the head. The economic discussion we're having It's understanding the language and understanding the basic concepts and that things have a cost, but it's also understanding that there's a process for all of this.
Yes, and I think it's, you know, when you run into people in business or elsewhere whom you want to have involved on a board or something like that, you realize that they're good decision makers, that you watch how they approach a problem. And they may not be any smarter, they may not be more expert than everybody in the room, but they ask the right questions, they consult the right data, they're willing to listen to people who know more than they do, and that gets them, and perhaps the organization for which they're working, to a better place.
It's a very interesting way of looking at it, because I think a lot of times it's the shortcuts that we want to take, and it's in everything. You know, that's why we have a lottery, right? I mean, well, we can make the argument that we have a lottery for tax revenue, but what's attractive about the lottery, or inheritance, or personal injury claim, or any other lightning strike of wealth, is because it is the ultimate shortcut.
Right. It's funny, when I was researching Naked Statistics, I encountered a story on the web about a guy who was struck by lightning on the way to buy a lottery ticket. And my response was, he got a low probability event, but it was not the one he was looking for.
Yeah, that's not the one you want. And that's an interesting example. So, and we know that these things are extraordinarily rare. And we also know that, and what's ironic is that when that lightning of wealth does strike, 4 out of 5 lottery winners or personal injury recipients, these windfalls are gone 4 out of 5 times within, say, 5 years. Because
right.
They got the money, but they didn't get the decision-making ability to come with it.
And ironically, I haven't looked at this literature in a long time, the only people who end up better off after winning the lottery are people who had a lot of money to begin with. Because they're using it because they earned it, and they have a set of behaviors that are already to make them well-equipped to deal with that sudden windfall.
Very good. Well, to get better equipped for such an event and for everything else, nakedeconomics.com, you can pick up Dr. Charles Whelan's books, and we will thank him, Dr. Charles Whelan, for being on the program. Doctor, we'll have you back. Great stuff, and I thank you for your time.
Oh, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland, and keep up with Scott Connor by following us on Twitter at Real Money Radio.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.